Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 2000, includes Dr. John Shoven, Professor Emeritus, Stanford University, and Ann Kruger, Professor Emeritus of Science and Humanities in Economics at Stanford University, discussing how difficult economic decisions are to make in a democracy. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Okay, well, John, you and I have, I think, quite different fields. You worry about Social Security and public finance, and I worry about international trade and international trade policies, and yet both of us, I think, are experiencing some of the same frustration with decision-making on some of these really critical issues in a democracy. What's the situation with Social Security?
Well, I think the political system has a great deal of difficulty in dealing with these long-run problems. And Social Security, its fundamental problem is the aging of the society, the baby boom generation, the longer lives that we're all leading. The system is officially scheduled to go bankrupt in the 2030s. Many of the critics think it's going to happen in maybe at 2015, and yet we're sort of dithering on doing anything. This is a problem which the longer you wait to do anything about, the worse it gets.
Why is that?
Well, one way to think about it is simply that the biggest group in the population is the baby boom generation. They are currently between, say, ages 35 and 50, 52 years old. They're in their peak earnings years. If we do something now, they could actually help towards the solution before they become, in some sense, a huge part of the problem.
By doing something, do you mean raise Social Security tax rates now?
Raise Social Security tax rates now, or tell them that we're going to have to raise the retirement age or cut benefits so they can prepare for these decisions. Whatever we're going to do, we'd be better off making the decisions now and letting the baby boomers adjust their behavior. Now, personally, I'm not for raising at least what I would call the tax rate. I think the current system offers a terribly low return for its participants. Depending on your circumstances, you might get a 2% return or a 1% return or a 0% return. And those all sound really bad compared to what capital earns in the United States. So I don't think we should simply enlarge the system. I think we should move to a partially funded system, generate more savings, more of this capital that reasonably earns 8%, say, a year, real after inflation. So that would be a better way to go.
But how would you do that? I mean, would you then have people doing their own private saving and private investment?
Well, first of all, I would have it mandatory. That is, I do think that we need some kind of mandatory program for retirement. And I would leave the government providing some base level of support. But over and above that, I would use individual accounts. The one thing we know for sure is the 401k accounts, the individual retirement accounts, are incredibly popular. I think we should have more of those kind of instruments, and less of a government-mandated transfer program. I don't know if I know you know it, but I don't know if it's widely known exactly how the Social Security system works. By and large, there's no savings involved. It's simply the workers transferring their money through the government and to the old people. There's no assets. There's no return for society. I think almost all economists believe that this worsens the savings rate and the wealth of the country. Now, let me just mention one other thing. I focus mostly on the retirement of the population. But even worse, or in worse financial shape, is the situation with respect to the health care of the elderly, the Medicare program. And that we also know it does not have enough money. In fact, one way to say it is we currently are promising people benefits that we know we can't afford. And we have to do one of two things. One is make sure that we can afford them, which involves raising contributions or raising tax rates, or scale back the promises. But right now, the promises are just not legitimate. We've known this for 20 years, and at least since the 83 Greenspan Commission. Actually, I think we knew it earlier than that, that the long-run system was unsustainable. We haven't done anything about it. And the problem in some sense simply compounds with interest. The more you have an unfunded liability that you don't take care of, the larger it gets. Just like if you're in debt, you not only continue to have that debt, you have to pay interest on the debt. And it's exactly like that that's going on in these programs.
Well, now you and I are both economists, of course, and so we look at these issues, and we'll talk later, I guess, a little bit about the international ones. But what do you think it is in the political system that prevents us from dealing rationally or dealing sensibly with these issues? I mean, perhaps people would disagree on a solution,
right.
But it seems to me that almost anybody presented with the facts, as you know, as you've said them and as I believe them to be, would agree there's a problem and that waiting is only going to make it worse.
Well, the components of a solution invariably require more individual contributions, be they taxes or to accounts, or lower benefits. Neither one of those are politically appealing. The problem is not going to occur in the next 2 years or even in the next 6 years. So it's outside the realm of the election cycle. It's a problem that at the minimum is 15 years away. And I think we're not very good at addressing those problems. Problems that can be pushed on to the next guy, that's what we do with them. An analogy that I often draw is with the savings and loan crisis. I actually was in Washington in 1980. You may have gone back and forth to Washington too. But economists that worried about things like the Social Security, like the savings and loan problem, knew that the savings and loan industry was wiped out by the 20% interest rates that prevailed in 1980. We knew that there was a bailout needed. We knew that the system basically had to be repaired. I think the members of Congress knew, everybody knew, that this was a problem. On the other hand, they were surviving. The problem could be postponed. It was postponed for almost a decade. It was much worse when we did clean it up. And in some simple sense, it simply compounded with interest throughout the decade of the 1980s. And finally, we had to face a pretty messy situation.
Well, now what finally led to cleaning it up?
Well, that's a good question.
Well, you know,
I don't know. I'm not sure on that one. I know the answer. I mean, it eventually got so large it couldn't be hidden. Also, the savings and loan industry began to take their incentives were to make very risky loans. They were already dead. Why not, take a chance on being resurrected? Mm-hmm. The incentives were all wrong, and eventually, I guess the newly elected George Bush decided to bite the bullet and clean up the mess, which he did. By the way, I believe that the Social Security problem and the Medicare problem are larger by a factor of 100 mm-hmm. than the Social Security than the savings and loan crisis. But that gave me a flavor of, wow, just because you know there's a problem doesn't mean you're going to fix it anytime
but
soon.
But in a way, I mean, that's when I asked, what led to fixing it, I mean, the question is it going to take something as bad as from what you described, the buildup of the SNL, before a politician grabs a hold of it, or indeed can something be done first? And I wonder if there's any analogy actually to right now, where we have all this discussion of now that the budget deficit is smaller than everybody thought, and we're running a surplus. And of course, some people are saying, well, let's put that towards Social Security. But then others are finding, at the margin they can spend on this side or the other. And others want a tax decrease once again. And I wonder if maybe this isn't the same kind of, well, we can put it off until finally it's going to hit us in the head.
Absolutely. First of all, I think we have no surplus other than the one that the Social Security is currently generating. The accounting on these problems is very bad. The liabilities are getting bigger. You would think if you're running a surplus that our net wealth would be going up. But in fact, our liabilities are going up. So you kind of know something is wrong there. But yeah, I mean, both parties, one party is advocating a tax cut and the other party is advocating spending programs. All of this surplus and more, I think, should be devoted to these long-run problems. So I'm a little pessimistic on this. By the way, every time Social Security has been revised in the past, 1977, 1983, it was right on the brink of a crisis. I mean, in 83, we waited until the checks were going to bounce within a few months. So there's not too much reason to be optimistic. I'm not sure, though, politically, whether it's been tested, whether if somebody actually sort of leveled with the public about the problem, whether that might not be politically popular.
But didn't I read something in the past couple of weeks to the effect that actually Social Security had been changed to those who are still in the 65 to 70 age range and working are now going to get full benefits?
Yep, they are.
Which goes in the opposite direction, doesn't it?
No, I actually think that's okay. This is the they've removed the earnings test, so you actually don't have to retire to collect Social Security. Once you're 65, you can decide when you want to start your Social Security, and you can separately decide when you want to retire. Now, the reason that does not actually hurt the finances of the system are a couple. One is, if you take the money early, mm-hmm. you get less per month in an actuarially fair basis. And two, if you decide to continue to work, you have to continue to pay Social Security taxes. So actually, if anything, I think it slightly helps the financial problems of the system. But I am concerned about our inability to come to grips with these long-run problems, the problems of an aging society. I wonder, I'm not much of an expert on things like global warming, but there's a really long-run problem and how well we're doing with that one.
Global warming is a little different, I think, in that a lot of the problem is gets back closer to my field, and it's between countries.
Yes.
There, the argument boils down to whether one should accept whatever standards of restriction are going to be on a basis of per capita, which is, of course, what all the developing countries want, or on a basis of current share of income, which is, of course, what all the developed countries want. And since those are two fairly implacable views, that's I think, a different, except because it's between countries rather than within.
Well, I agree. And the other thing about global warming is there's still a lot of scientific dispute about how serious or whether it's happening. On the Social Security one or on the Medicare one, there's no dispute. Mm-hmm. The own trustees, the Secretary of Treasury is one of the trustees, declare this. But we should get back to, I'd like to know more about what's going on in your with your interest in the international trade area. But before we do, I just wanted to make one assertion, which is, while I've been picking on the U.S. And its ability to handle some of these long-run problems, I did want to contrast that with my own view that the U.S. is the best-performing economy in the world, has been for the last 20 years, and just sort of remind all of us that we're doing a lot of things right. I think we've the deregulation we've had over the last 20 years has been helpful. Actually, I think the general direction of tax policy over the last 20 years has been helpful. The financial markets of the U.S. are the envy of the world and have really helped fuel this engine of innovation that we have. So I'm not pessimistic about the U.S. economy, but there are some elements, and they tend to be these long-run problems that we just have a terrible time coming to grips with. I think the problem is more politics than economics, to be honest.
Right. Well, I mean, of course, I agree with you. The U.S. economy has performed very well, but it seems to me that that part of the reason for that good performance is indeed that some of these measures to address problems were taken, deregulation and so on, before crisis hit.
Yes.
And so we kept on going, whereas some of the European economies were waiting until things really kicked in. And of course, you're right also in the sense that some of the other industrial economies have even more rapid demographic transitions.
Absolutely.
And more of a Social Security problem than we do. So all of that is quite true, but I still think that we could run into trouble if we leave some of these big problems unaddressed and then have the same kind of crisis as, for example, the Japanese hit in the early 1990s.
Absolutely. So let me turn it around to you. And I think a lot of people think the U.S. is a great champion of free trade, but I'm not sure you're one of those people. So why don't you inform me about U.S. trade policy and also what you think, is the world trading system improving in a way that you're satisfied with, or what's going on?
How many hours do I have to answer?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a complicated set of questions. The U.S. after the Second World War was clearly the most open economy, and not only that, we led the charge. And what everybody's forgotten is even American labor unions were pro-free trade as an official policy position until the late 1960s. So there is no question that we led the charge, and there's no question, but 1948 to 73, let's say, was a quarter century of more rapid world economic growth than ever in human history. In fact, probably more than any century in human history. It really was a marvelous success. Starting sometime in the late 1970s, other countries had recovered, partly again as a result of our intelligent moves earlier, and partly as a result of their own. We were no longer as preponderant, and meanwhile, various things happened that led us away from quite the pure path. And in fact, one could argue that the real break was under President Reagan in 1986, when for the first time a high American official said, our official policy is we support free but fair trade. And all of a sudden, the question of what was fair came into the whole thing. And this has changed the nature of things considerably. And Americans, I think, have forgotten that there are lots of people in the world who aren't as affluent as we are. Not only are we the most successful over the last 20 years, as you said, but we had incredibly high living standards at the start of that period. So our wealth is unbelievable. And a lot of the perceived, quote, unfairnesses, unquote, actually go to different countries' relative competitive positions. And the one I think of course, is labor standards, where obviously, in poor countries, people have low wages. They have low wages because their productivity is low, which, of course, is why they're poor. And what one wants to do is raise that productivity. And as that happens, things can get better. Now, one trouble with this is that to raise productivity very quickly, one really needs to, especially if you're a small country, rely on open international markets. Then we hear all kinds of complaints. Well, this is unfair. It's unfair either because these people aren't paid enough. Well, they're not paid enough because they're not productive enough. Or it's unfair because of, well, working conditions aren't quite what we, the rich, think they ought to be. And which, by the way, they weren't here as we were in the process of getting rich either. So then you get a whole mess of issues of which that fairness is one, closed markets somewhere else. Therefore, we should close our own, which is kind of like saying, well, you shot yourself in the foot. That was not a good idea. So I'll prove it by shooting myself in the foot. I mean, this doesn't make sense. And yet we're getting a lot of this kind of fairness issue in trade, some of which is, I think, a genuine concern, but much of which is seized upon by those who really want protection for their own selfish reasons.
Now, one thing I noticed in not with our professional economist friends, but with just the people I know that you might characterize as the people on the street, they don't seem to appreciate the lower prices they enjoy because of free trade. They don't realize that that piece of porcelain made in Sri Lanka is a lot cheaper than it would be if it had been made in Vermont. You may have some specific people who feel they've been harmed by trade, and you don't hear from the vast majority of people who are benefiting every day when they go shopping.
Well, not only every day when they go shopping to buy the piece made in Taiwan, but they benefit every day even when they buy an American automobile, because even the U.S. auto industry has become more productive and more efficient since foreign competitors forced them to do so. And I think the value of competition in general is underappreciated by the public. And just simply having more producers that can supply something seems to be terribly important in terms of the health of an economy. And you could argue, again, going back to we are a productive economy theme, that one of the reasons we are is that we have a large domestic market where it's very tough to put too many impediments to trade, and that that's kept us in some sense with a little more competition than other countries. The other puzzle, though, and I agree with you about special interests, so maybe we can come back to that, but there's another puzzle. There are an awful lot of Americans whose jobs depend on exports. Boeing, workers at Boeing are an obvious example, but American farmers to a fair degree. Actually, you and I are both at a university, and universities are becoming major exporters of educational services. And a whole variety of others. And yet we who are in a sense dependent on the export side also don't speak up very much when it comes to the protectionist issues. And this is where I see a difficulty, if you like, with decision making in the Democrat process. Do you know that under U.S. trade law, when somebody says goes to the relevant authorities and says, I want to argue that I've been harmed because it was unfair competition in the various ways that they can legally do, that it is there's nothing in the law that permits any evidence about the effect that that protection would have on other industries or on American consumers. That's inadmissible evidence. We don't even take it into account. If you can show by law, and the law, by the way, is pretty tilted.
Right.
But if you can show by law that something happened that, quote, hurt your industry, then you are entitled to protection, regardless of whether, in fact, any third grader could prove that it would hurt the whole economy. I mean, it's very much an industry-specific set of protective measures that we now have.
Now, if back to the consumer role, if I go shopping at Costco or Sears or any other store, is it your sense that I'm paying noticeably higher prices today because of that I would be if we had truly free trade? That is, or is it really hurting me that these fair trade advocates and these protectionists, have they actually succeeded in raising my prices at this point?
Well, on some items, yes. And as I said, the reduction in competition is something that we just don't know how to measure how much that would do. Right. By the way, even reduction in innovation. I mean, in the early 1970s, most Americans knew that if they bought a car that had been produced in Detroit, that they were going to take it back a fair number of times. And there are statistics on this.
Absolutely.
Before the car functioned, right? And one of the shifts was to the cars that were imported that didn't have as many flaws. Well, as that showed American companies what consumers wanted, it had a great deal to do with improving the quality even of American cars, and that same thing has gone on in many other sectors. So you're paying higher prices insofar as that, but the estimate is that for textiles and clothing you're probably paying about 30% more than you otherwise would, and that's not a small amount, and that hurts the poor.
Right.
Maritime shipping is a big one where the estimate is about 80% more. Sugar is about 200% more, which is to say, and the sugar thing is incredible, and it's an incredible instance of very few people getting fairly large gains, most of which are so large that if they could see the light of day, the public would really object, and lots of people paying, you know, for their pound of sugar, 10 or 20, 15 cents more than they should. But you can name all kinds of other items where there's protection. We protect a number of farm imports, too. It is, goods that should be imported more. So there's a fair variety of protection. Interesting estimates are in some of these cases that some of these protectionist measures have cost as much as $80,000, $100,000, $200,000 per year per job saved.
So that's a great point. So mm-hmm. If we add up all the losers, mm-hmm. the losses of the losers, and compare it to the gains of the protected, the losses of the losers vastly.
Oh, sure. Well, if
they're much larger.
Take an estimate from 10 years ago, which at that time, when we had the voluntary export restraints on autos in the early 80s, the estimate at that time was it was about $180,000 cost to the American public somehow or other per year, per job saved in Detroit, where the average wage was on the order of $40,000. You know, what that really says is that you could have paid those auto workers their $40,000, which is what they got to stay home, lowered the price of cars, which was up about $2,000 then from what it would have been, by about, let's say, $1,800, put a $200 tax on consumption of all cars, domestic and foreign, to finance the workers, and everybody would have been better off.
So it's a pure waste. There's a lot of waste involved
in it. There's also, however, the perception of the auto workers that they kept their jobs. So it isn't like Social Security, which I suppose in a sense you could say everybody at some point is going to have to face up to this. I mean, there are some people who in the short run gain. One interesting thing is that probably the big gainers were the owners of the shares in the companies, because the companies might have had more of an adjustment.
Now, there are some industries that have essentially disappeared from the U.S., like manufacturing television sets.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably a good thing, right? I mean, this idea that we have to be completely self-sufficient and produce everything mm-hmm. here, it probably makes no sense.
Yeah, well, we could, after all.
We're good at some things and not as good at others.
We could, after all, grow bananas in greenhouses, too. I mean, of course you can do everything. But certainly those industries have disappeared. On the other hand, if they hadn't disappeared, prices would have been much higher.
Right.
And with that, the market would have been much smaller. What I think people don't, textiles and clothing is, again, a good case in point. If my memory serves, in 1900, something like 12% of the non-agricultural labor force was employed in manufacturing textiles and clothing in the U.S. Even before there was any substantial amount of imports, that fraction of the labor force had fallen dramatically. It was down below 4% at the time when all of these other measures were taken to, quote, save these jobs in textiles. And what measures they took then mostly permitted jobs to move from north to south. I mean, the effects were very different than intended. So, but on the other hand, there are these groups who do see themselves as threatened, and that's what makes it very tough, I think, to do social policy as contrasted with Social Security or something like that.
Now, how do the Americans How does the American stance on free trade relate to, say, the Europeans? Are they better than us, are they singing the same song? What's the story there?
Well, historically, of course, there was more protection in most of Europe. Mm-hmm. So historically, I think there's no question that our claim was right. Statistically, the best guesstimate today is that if you were to take a weighted average somehow measured of tariffs in Europe, they're on the order of 3-4%. If you take a measure of ours, they're 3-4%. If you take a measure of Japanese, they're 3-4%. We've gotten tariffs down so successfully and so much that it's a lot of these non-tariff barriers that are really the obstacles in today's world, and they're harder to negotiate down. But I guess there, most people would claim that maybe the Europeans and the Japanese have somewhat more, although the argument is that the Japanese protection is so hidden we can't identify it, which sometimes worries me in terms of where it really is. They have a very old-fashioned or whatever distribution system that is high cost and that undoubtedly plays some of this role, so there's something to that. In the case of Europe, they have high protection on agriculture, but as I said, some of our agriculture is fairly highly protected too. Rice growing in this country,
absolutely,
for example, where water subsidies are big, and then we get unhappy with the Japanese is a case in point. So I think we always present ourselves as being 100% pure. And I think that makes our trading partners mad, because we're not. And on the other hand, while we're not 100% pure, we're arguably no worse than the other guy.
Now, I always had a view, your field is not my field, but if we looked at the politics of this, I tend to believe that the president or the executive branch has been pretty free trade, and Congress has been the problem, that the Congress is often more influenced by these calls for protectionism. Is that an accurate portrayal? Who are the political actors here? Who are the good guys and who are the bad guys?
Well, there's some good guys and some bad guys, I think, in both parties. I don't think it's only a party issue. I think historically, you're right, the president has tended to be more pro-free trade, more open economy. And by the way, there's every evidence that more open economies do perform more satisfactorily. And one argument for that, of course, is foreign policy as well as trade policies involved. And I think most of the congressmen who are dealing with their constituents are looking at the domestic or the economic implications, and they're forgetting the foreign policy. And that may be one reason the executive is more open. A second reason, of course, is they are balancing off more interests. If you are a senator from a state in which they have a very strong concentration of workers in a particular industry, it's very hard to be pro-free trade for that particular industry. If you're going to lose all those votes, you won't be there, and there'll be somebody else who will do it. So I think all of these things go in there, but the power of special interests is still worrying to me, at least. It makes, I think, any kind of balancing off of interest much tougher than it would otherwise be.
Could our the gains of trade seem like one of the fundamental principles of economics?
Mm-hmm.
If we know anything, we know that there are gains from trade, and that can be said in terms of a domestic economy, mm-hmm, or a world economy. But so, is it a failure of the economics profession to tell people the lesson and teach the lesson and convince people that we're right and that we know something? Should we blame ourselves for this seeming, we seem to have stalled in terms of
We certainly
trade.
At least stalled. And, of course, now we're getting this anti-globalization stuff. Although there, people aren't even articulating what it is that is they object to. They're just sort of saying there's globalization and this must be bad. And I sometimes wonder if maybe we shouldn't just show a few movies of what life is really like in some of these poor villages around the world, and that might make a difference. I don't know. Obviously, we haven't gotten our message across as well as we should. Obviously, there are some who do stand to gain. As I said, the owners of machinery in industries that would likely close down faster do stand to gain by protection. But obviously, if you're the owner of some factory that's going to happen to, you're not going to stand there and say, please give me protection on account of how otherwise I'll lose my shirt. You're going to say you must protect to save jobs and all these good things, and try and get your labor union to go along with you. And I think something of that happens. And then, in addition, you get other very well-meaning people, the environmentalists sometimes, these others, or these who think that, the overseas, they really ought to pay as well as American workers and don't understand that that's really not possible. And those kind of groups go in, and all of a sudden the labor unions sound like they're environmentalists. And everybody's sort of hiding behind whatever they can. And this gives a lot of confusion, I think, in the whole thing, which is very tough to offset.
One question that probably neither you nor I can answer, but is whether an American politician, perhaps, say, running for president, could say flat out, I am by and large for free trade, that's my fundamental principle. I'm also for addressing the intergenerational issues that I was talking about mm-hmm. earlier, and that in fact we should worry at least as much about the young and unborn as we're worrying about the current elderly. Mm-hmm. Could such a person get elected?
That's a really hard question. Now, of course, if he said, I'm by and large for free trade, then the worry is that on the side, somebody comes in and persuades him, well, yes, you're by and large for free trade, but of course we have the textiles and clothing right. and somebody else's, but we also have the rice. And pretty soon, I mean, being almost for free trade seems to be non-viable in that then these pressures build up on all these sides and one by one, one gives in. Now, on Social Security, it is more across the board. And it seems to me, as I think about what we're talking about, the difficulties of confronting it politically, what I see is kind of the power of special interest emerging and the whittling away and all that kind of thing. It's quite different from this inability of the political system to face up to this massive across-the-board crisis that you're talking about.
Right. By the way, just one thing on Social Security that occurred to me that I should mention to you. I did some recent research on the history of Social Security, and everybody knows that Franklin Roosevelt is the father of the New Deal and Social Security. It turns out that he rejected a pay-as-you-go system. That he didn't want a pay-as-you-go system. He wanted a funded Social Security system. He actually mentioned at one point he thought it would be immoral to ask the young people to pay for the retirements of the old people and to get an unfunded liability and all that. What happened, interestingly, was that he could not get Congress to raise the contribution rates to build up the trust fund, and he could not stop them from raising the benefits. And we slipped into mm-hmm. a pay-as-you-go system. And it's, again, so in a way, it was the Congress in the early 1940s, during the war, late in the 30s, that were unwilling to actually implement the 1935 Social Security law, which was for a funded Social Security system.
That's interesting.
And it was until 1950 when, by 1950, we had skipped three or four payroll increases, tax increases, mm-hmm. and we had slipped to a pay-as-you-go system, never legislated.
Well, that, of course, I mean, these unintended consequences of things that start out fairly clean is, I think, comparable to my whittling away. The candidate who would say, I'm just about for free trade, but then
yep.
can't quite do this, that, or the other. That sounds much more the same kind of thing, that yes, in principle, you're for it, but at the moment, it's not convenient kind of an approach which seems to take sort of an issue in all this.
You know, it seems like there is an area that... could use even more research, which is the interaction between politics and economics. Because we think that we have some answers, but somehow the political system doesn't deliver them. One thing I've noticed when I go to Washington to talk to various members of the House or the Senate, they actually understand Social Security. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're lacking leadership or will or something, but it's not like they don't know the kinds of things that I'm talking about. They know the system is unsustainable, they know it has to be changed, and they're in no rush to do it.
That's I think a little different. I think there's more disagreement within Congress and much more sense on the part of some very otherwise honorable congressmen, or honorable even in that regard. I don't know whether to say it's misinformation or this specific political pressure and the fact that voters themselves will put pressure when it's their own industry and don't, as you say, ever see the consumer. I'm not sure. There is a lot of research going on in the political economy of trade policy. That's one area where I think people are thinking about it. But one thing I discovered, which is interesting, is that while we economists say, how come there's so much protection? There are some political scientists who look and they say, look, those guys are, the producers are overseas. They don't have the same power as domestic producers. How come there's so little protection? So there's a different political viewpoint on all this than there is economic, and that may be important to think about too. But it is a puzzle as to how you get good economic policy.
Well, I've learned a lot from this. One thing I, at least, you focused me on was this waste caused by the protection,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and that the economy as a whole loses a lot more than the protected gain. An analogy I would make in public finance that we see all the time is that if you put a tax in place, and you compare the burden that that tax imposes on the economy compared to the revenue it raises, it actually, the burdens sum up to much more than the revenue.
Oh, sure.
Often you'll have a tax which may raise $50 billion, which does $100 billion worth of harm to the economy. Mm-hmm. And then you have to figure out, well, am I going to be able to spend this $50 billion mm-hmm. in a way to do $100 billion worth of good? Because So there is this, when you intervene in the economy, you have to worry about these small losses that affect 250 million people, and they can amount to a lot.
Right. But as we've also talked about, what's interesting is this kind of whittling away at some kind of principle, which seems to go on. And it seems to me one of the lessons is that some very well-intentioned people can do something like start Social Security, but then by the time it's done, it may not look like what it was supposed to look like. And the same is true, I think, in trade policy a lot.
I guess they call that the slippery slope. You get on that slope and you give a little and everything's a precedent, and we've both been there.
Yeah. Well, I think we can both agree that there's a lot that we need to learn about the political economy of all this.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's
been
fun.
Great talking with you. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.